main outdoors is waiting for all of us to see. The mountains, lakes, and rivers, the wildlife, and the woods are just outside your doorway. So get outside and find it in the main outdoors. Fishing and hunting, winter, spring, summer, and fall. If it happens in the main outdoors, they talk about it all. Just tune in your radio to 103.9. Jim and Paul and Bob and Matt are your outdoors hotline. Each Sunday night at 7 on WVOM. To find out what is happening, just listen to the radio to the main outdoors.
Welcome to the main outdoors. Here's tonight's host, V. Paul Reynolds.
And you know, I'm not sure what it's like where you are right now, but today on Branch Lake, where I live in Ellsworth, it was a spectacular summer day. I mean, summer has finally arrived in Maine, I guess.
I feel for you, though, really. Oh, yeah. I really do. You poor fellow.
Yeah. Anyway, it was beautiful down there, absolutely gorgeous, and we hope you enjoyed part of this wonderful Maine day. And we'd like to welcome you to our program tonight. We have an exciting program lined up. I'm going to introduce our guests in just a moment, but if you'd like to be on our program, we invite you to do so, as you know, every week right here in Maine Outdoors. We have a number, statewide toll-free number, which is
1-800-966-103.9.
Excellent.
That's our call letters.
That is, right. And you're listening to us on the Voice of Maine News Talk Network, in case you're guessing, WVOM, which is 103.9, and 101.3 down in Rockland.
Augusta. Augusta.
Right, 1450 in Rockland, right?
A.M.
A.M., yeah, you bet.
You bet.
Okay, that's the lowdown on the station, and we I'd like to get calls from as far away as we can. So if you're up there in western Maine somewhere and you want to call in, we get excited. Right, Bob?
We certainly do.
Yeah. Okay, I'll introduce our guests in just a minute. First, the crew that make this show possible every week. The engineer, right there, Mr. Scotty Bates. Take a bow, Scotty.
Yes, good evening, Paul and Bob. And boy, you're right. It was a warm one today, but love it.
Oh, we love it. Love warm. And with him is the other backup engineer. I can't see him. Can I see? I can't see you, Norm. I see your hand. Anyway, he is the chili expert in New England, Mr. Norm Plord. Take a bow, Norm.
Good evening. I really like the AC in here.
The AC is not working well, huh?
Oh, no. It feels good.
Oh, they sometimes turn that off on the weekend.
He's the scourge of Grand Lake Stream.
He is. The scourge of Grand Lake Stream.
He is. Yeah, that's what I call him.
Okay.
Haven't been down there lately, have you?
No.
Our guest tonight is a fellow that I ended up talking to when I got excited about the Alewife Run, which I saw down at Weber Pond this spring. And I thought it might be interesting to get him on to talk with us. He's a fisheries biologist with the Maine Department of Marine Resources. I'd like to welcome Mr. Nate Gray. Nate, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to get into a lot of things besides alewives. Nate is also an avid sportsman. He's a hunter, fisherman, and camper. And it says right here on this little resume I have here, he's also a spinner of yarns.
Yes.
And we'll have to delve into that a little bit before the show's over.
Yeah, he means fly tie, I know.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
And if you'd like to be in our program, you know we welcome you to call in at 1-800-966-1039. Before we get to Nate, though, we have Outdoor Digest brought to you by the Northwood Sporting Journal. And that is Norm Plord's very, very favorite outdoor publication. If you'd like to get a subscription, you may do so by calling the office weekdays at 732-4880.
Oh, you've got a good memory.
732-4880.
You've lost a little of it tonight, though.
Yeah, well, yeah. And
you didn't introduce your co-host.
I forgot to introduce you? You've got to be kidding.
I'm not kidding.
I did 20 lashes with a wet noodle.
You certainly do.
Well, I'm glad you spoke up.
You got everybody else.
How did I forget you?
Well,
our co-host.
Probably not easy.
Well, drum roll, please. Drum roll, Mr. Engineer.
Hey.
That's a good drum roll.
All right. There we go.
Our co-host tonight, he is a registered master Maine guide. He is an author of not one, not two, but three wonderful fishing books.
Thank you so much.
And he is a sartorial dresser, my friend Robert F. Lehman.
And I have my, as usual, L.L. Bean shirt on tonight.
There you go. And again, a thousand apologies.
Oh, no problem. No problem.
Okay, where were we? Outdoor Digest brought to you by the Northwood Sporting Journal. And the gal to call is Alicia. If you want to get a subscription to the journal, 732-4880. Just a couple things before we get to Bob's fishing report. checked out the fish stocking list for this spring. Do you ever check that out on the website, the IFNW website?
Not lately, but I usually do every year. But I like to get the natives.
Yeah.
I'm a native man.
Well, anyway, the fish stocking is always important to people because it tells you where the good fishing might be. But anyway, something that puzzled me, and maybe you can address this. I don't know, Nate. But I was looking down the fish stocking list, like Branch Lake, they put in 8,000 fingerling salmon back in May.
Mm-hmm.
Coldstream Pond, they put in a bunch of brookies. But then, you're talking like sometimes it's like 800, 500 of these, 1,000 of these. And then it said 34,756. And then these were brookies. And then it said 1 inch. Do they stock fish small? Was that a typo in the fishing report?
No. I really can't even speak to that.
Don't know. Huh?
No, I really don't know.
Yeah.
They wouldn't stock them that small.
No.
Fingerlings are bigger than that.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
They do stock fingerlings, as you know.
But it right on the website, on the stocking report, in two different columns.
I'd say that's a misprint.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah. I don't know.
That's small. Yeah. That'd be biomass.
That's a lot of biomass.
Much more than an egg.
But anyway, the fishing stocking report for spring is out there. If you want to check it out on a pond that you're interested in, you can do it online on the IFNW website. It's quite an interesting thing to look around and get an idea for the stocking program. The state stocks a lot of fish. They really do. Also, the any deer permits. A lot of questions about that, and I've nailed that down, and here's the deal. If you want to apply for an any deer permit, you can do so effective July 1st. Now, I looked at it today, and then there was no place there where I could apply yet, but I'm sure by tomorrow there will be. And from then on, you have until August 15th, which is the final day of applying for your any deer permit. So you'll have the month of July, half a month of August, and you don't get anything in the mail anymore. There are no more hard copy permits. You have to apply online to get an any deer permit. And a little asterisk with that, they're giving out the highest number of doe permits this year than they have in the history of Maine, which is kind of surprising when you know there are some places in Maine where the deer populations are pretty low. But in many of the southern, central, western states, the deer have come back to the point where they want to try to take more does than they historically have. So if you're in any of those areas, you've got a pretty good chance to get a doe permit. Now, you're a deer hunter, Nate, right?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yeah. Now, will you be applying for a doe permit?
Yes, I will.
Yeah, me too.
Yep.
I will as well. And I think Norm Plord, Norm, do you apply for those?
I do.
You do,
I got one last year. A doe permit. I didn't get a doe.
Yeah.
I had a permit.
Yeah, okay. All right, anyway, remember that. And right now, though, it's time for Bob's favorite music. Yeah.
And you work for me.
Yeah.
This is my rock.
Yeah. Okay, Bob's favorite music about the big bass. Are you a bass guy, Nate?
I'll fish for whatever's out there.
There you go. Me too. Me too. So what's going on in the bass
Before I get rolling, I want to say hello to the L.L. Bean lady I talked to this week,
mm-hmm.
and she's going to be an avid listener to our show from now on, and I've forgotten her name, but you know now that I'm talking about you, if you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the show, and I hope you have some friends down there. You'll tell about the show. Thank you so much,
okay.
And I hope it comes in clear down in Freeport. I think it does, doesn't it?
Oh, she's the lady you talked to about the crummy waiters you sold me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's right.
All right.
I didn't sell them to you. I loaned them to you.
Okay.
Anyway, have you been fishing for bass down there? Do you see any beds around the shore? They must still be.
Yeah,
They got to be still be on the beds.
They're still on the beds. Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
For sure.
That's more fun than anything, fishing for bass on the beds.
Oh, yeah. Bass fishing's good right now, yeah.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Yeah.
This morning in church, I talked to a young man. His name escapes me now. He's a woolly bugger. One of the new members, and he went up to Rapid River this week, he was telling me, with his buddy, and he didn't tell me exactly where they fish, but they had a ball with big trout.
There are some big trout in there,
They got a 20-incher and a couple of 15s, besides a lot of 14s,
nice.
13s, 14s. Yeah. You know what they got them on?
A Parachute Adams number 16.
Not a Homburg either.
A woolly bugger?
A woolly bugger.
No, no.
give me a hint.
Nate knows.
What?
What's hatching right now, Nate? And big, great big wings.
Drakes, oh, right. Yeah, green drake.
Green drake. Hexagenia limbata.
That's
Paul
it.
Paul knows that.
You've
seen him down at the lake.
Yeah, I showed you a picture here before the show. Josh took a picture of one. I took a picture of one.
Yeah.
And so that's exciting.
It is.
So if you're a trout fisherman,
ooh,
be aware, the green drake hatches out. And
yes,
as those of us who study that know, they're not really truly the green drake, right, Bob?
No, they're not. They're actually a good imitation is about the best. If you don't really know, you must have some muddlers in your box. A good-sized muddler is as close as you can get. It's kind of a brownish. And another good imitation for the nymph, believe it or not, is a golden retriever.
Hmm.
Yeah, and Nate is shaking his head yes, because that works. If you want to fish deep and kind of work it up, let it go down, work it up in short jerks. If there's a good rise in a trout pond and there's some hatching of limbatas going on, they're not really, they're kind of dimpling the surface and gobbling, but you can't seem to fool them. So try the imitation nymph.
All right.
The golden retriever. I've had really good luck with that. Let it sink. Then bring it up in short drinks. And, have faith. Have faith and keep trying. It'll work.
All right.
Really works good.
Okay. Anything else in the fishing world?
Well, there's a lot more, but that's about my time tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Nice fishing report.
Okay. Thank you,
sir.
Yeah,
excellent.
Yep.
And we used to fight about the Hexagenia limbata, but how come we don't fight about that anymore?
Well, because I won.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Some white flag.
Yeah. That concludes the fishing report. And now we, again, our Nate Gray, who's a fisheries biologist with the Maine Department of Marine Resources, is our studio guest. We'll be talking to him in just a minute. First, we have a trivia question we'd like to dispose of. And Bob has generously volunteered to offer up one of his books. Right, Bob?
Actually, I'm going to give a fly away tonight, a hand-tied.
Oh, a hand-tied fly, okay.
One of my own creations.
Okay, and you have it right in your formerly nicotine-stained fingers.
How's it look to you?
Oh, Bob, that is gorgeous.
You know who made that, who packaged that up for me like that? Ed Harris. Ed Curtis, excuse me.
Okay, so you got a new card behind it.
Emeritus, yes.
Very, very sexy, very nice.
Isn't
that pretty, Nate? Look at that. It's Bob Smelt. That looks like a little bit like a gray ghost. You didn't copy that from Kerry Stevens, did you?
Wow, that is nice.
Isn't that nice looking fly?
It's kind of a spin-off of a lot of creations, actually.
Okay, so you're going to give that away.
That's from, as I said, packaging is one of our sponsors, Creative Enterprises, Ed Curtis. You know Ed.
Yes, I do,
He does a nice job, doesn't he, on that CAD? That's a new CAD.
Beautiful. Just
new packaging,
beautiful.
Looks beautiful.
Okay, here's the question.
Plus, I tied the flies.
Here's the question. To win one of Bob's flies. Are you going to let me do the question? Here we go.
Oh, you're going to do the question.
Okay, what are the special conditions that allow a person to hunt deer during the archery season with a crossbow? Okay, you ponder that. We'll be right back. And the number to call is 1-800-966-1039.
Wrong one. There we go.
Okay. All right. I thought there was a switchy problem there.
Yeah.
Okay, caller, we want you to tell us, we asked the question, what are the special conditions that allow a person to hunt deer during the archery season using a crossbow? And what do you think the answer is? What's your first name, caller, and the answer, please?
Now, my name is Aaron, and I am going to say either disabled or senior citizen.
Okay, that's pretty good. Senior citizen of what age?
I'm going to say 75.
Oh, no, that's not the right answer.
68.
No. We're easy on this program. I'll give you one more stab at it, but you got to get the right age, or we're going to have to click you off and find another caller. Sorry, but
I'm going to go 70 then.
70. No, none of those answers are correct, but you came awful close, and we appreciate your call, Aaron.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we got another caller online.
Yes, we do. We got another caller. I didn't get his name.
He had the wrong switch down.
And we got another caller online. Yes, we do.
Are you there, caller?
Yes.
What's your first name, sir?
Richard.
Okay, Richard, what do you think the answer is?
I think it's the age would be 65.
Ah, bingo, that's correct. You have the right answer, and you've won a Bob's new fly called a Bob Smelt, which is a beautiful piece of work.
Thank you.
Super.
And if you will stay on the line, Richard, our engineer will get your mailing address, and Bob will send it right out to you. Right, Bob?
Tomorrow morning.
Beautiful. Thank you very much.
No, thanks for calling.
And you listening.
Okay, and congratulations, and thanks for listening, Richard.
Yep, thank you, too. Bye-bye.
Okay, stay on the line. Yep, bye-bye. Okay. All right, that was the right answer. 65 years of age or older, which means that you and I, Bob, can hunt during the
crossbow
archery season with a crossbow.
Yeah. Have you ever done that?
Yes, I have.
Have you really? Do you own one?
Down in Maryland, no. I borrowed a friend's, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
A little awkward carrying it through the woods, though.
I would think, yeah. Didn't have any luck with it.
I felt like Errol Flynn.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. No, but they're a very accurate weapon, and
I would
a lot
think
of bow
so.
Hunters don't I like them. They frown so. On them. What's your position on that, Nate? You?
It's all some sort of advantage, right? You know, it beats throwing rocks at them.
Yeah.
They work.
Well, for folks who aren't physically able to pull back a bow, I think it's a nice compromise.
Yeah, I do too.
You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it gives them a chance to get out and hunt during deer season.
Sure does.
During bow season. Okay, let's get down to business here. If you just joined us, again, our special studio guest is Nate Gray. Nate's a fisheries biologist for the Maine Department of Marine Resources. And that's a state agency. I used to think it was part of conservation, but it's a separate state agency, Nate informed me. And we're going to talk about a lot of different things. But before we get down to talking about some of the fish and some of the big rivers here in Maine, would you tell our folks at home a little bit about yourself, Nate?
Well, my name is Nate. I grew up in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Lived there for 13 years. I got to watch pretty much the last huge heydays of the ground fishing fleet in Gloucester slowly decline and basically disappear, or at least become a ghost of what it once was. It came from a fairly outdoor-oriented family. We grew up learning how to fly fish. You learned how to fly fish or you didn't fish. And then I spent some time down in Connecticut, and then I disappeared out to Alaska after I graduated from high school and did all sorts of fun stuff out there as a young man. It's a great place to chase around and find out what you're made out of. So it was a really good time. And then I started going to school at Unity College and bouncing back and forth between Alaska and Unity, and wound up basically getting recruited to the Department of Marine Resources in 1992. And I've been working there ever since.
And needless to say, you love Alaska because you go back there quite a bit, right?
Yeah. My wife and I just recently had two children, and I'd like to do a shout-out now to them, Henry and John, my sons, and my lovely wife, Jessica. Henry's 4, John is 2. And don't have much spare time to go out to Alaska when you have young boys. And this year, my wife graciously allowed me to go, and it was great to get back out there and do some fishing.
Okay. So. Maybe you would talk to my wife, because I'd like to make one more elk trip.
Okay.
And I'm having a little trouble selling that. Would you talk to her?
Yeah, I need her phone number.
I'll give you her number and you can give her a call.
Yeah, I will.
Appreciate it, Nate. Yeah. Well, good. You have quite a background, and you obviously a guy who not only love to fish, but I'm sure you love what you're doing. And one of the things that interested me was our discussion about having witnessed an alewife run down at Weber Pond, which I think is your beat, right?
Yes, it sure is.
Work. And I was just, I've seen smelt runs, but I never saw anything like this in my life.
Really?
And I was just flabbergasted by the amount of fish that were struggling in that shallow water to get into that lake. Yeah. Tell us about that, would you?
Okay, you hit right close to the middle of the dartboard for alewives and myself. I worked extensively on the Weber Pond run. We began doing a whole bunch of work on the pond itself, doing some reintroduction for alewives on the pond. We were keeping track of species assemblage, water quality through DEP and their volunteer water quality monitoring program. And we were pretty sure that Edwards Dam was going to come out. And so we started a slow, very low level 2 fish per acre stocking program with broodstock alewives into Weber Pond. Of course, in 1999, they remove Edwards Dam, and now Weber Pond is open to the ocean, and it has everything it needs except for a fish passage. So I started collecting, you know, grant money, putting together a package, and getting engineering done for the installation of a fish passage facility, which is what you saw. And that came online in 2009, and it's been running gangbusters ever since.
And last year, I found out there were 350,000 alewives that got into this one pond.
Yes.
Incredible.
And, yeah, and it's part of a chain of ponds. Well, there's another one up above it called Three Mile Pond, and that's an additional 1,500 acres, about 3,000 acres all told, or close to it. And this year, the numbers returning were even higher.
Okay, we have a phone call. Can we take a call right now? Do we have time before the break?
We got about a minute and a half.
All right, let's take a call. We have a question. Good evening, caller. You're on Maine Outdoors with fisheries biologist Nate Gray.
Yes, my name is Bill from Damariscotta, and I just have a short story to compliment V. Paul Reynolds. I was planning last week to go to Baxter State Park and hike into Center Pond, which is quite a hike in. It's almost 5 miles, and I went to the local library to use the computer, and I Googled Center Pond in Baxter State Park, and lo and behold, there was an article by V. Paul Reynolds written back in 2016 about that very pond and what good trout fishing there was. So I just wanted to mention that and compliment Mr. Reynolds for his article.
Well, thank you. Have you. So you went to the pond, right?
Yes, I did, but I almost died on that hike.
That's a long way. I've made that, yeah. But great fishing, huh?
Very good fishing. Yeah. A lot of action on streamers and dry flies. And
all right, great. Appreciate the call.
Outdoors.
Thank you.
On
we'll be right back.
1.3 Augusta, 103.9 Bangor, AM 1450 Rockland, the voice of Maine.
Okay, we're back with Maine Outdoors, and again, if you joined us late, our studio guest is Nate Gray. He's a fisheries biologist with the Maine Department of Marine Resources. If you'd like to ask a question of Nate, you can do so by calling what number, Bob?
1-800-966-1039.
All right. Before the break, we were talking about the alewives, and you just I was amazed to learn that this year, according to Nate, there were over 400,000 alewives made their way into Weber Pond. What's the size of Weber Pond? Not that big.
Weber Pond is about 1,500 acres, if I recall correctly. It's not that huge.
I'm trying to think of some pond around here it would compare with, but it's not that big a pond to be.
No.
And those fish will be there for a while, and then they'll head back to sea, right?
Yeah, the adults will come in and they'll spawn. Spawning usually occurs over a couple of weeks, and you got to remember the whole run occurs over about 5 or 6 weeks. So the fish that get in there, the earliest, of course, are the first ones to try to drop out after they spawn. The adults will try to leave. Many will. Some won't survive the trip. It's pretty tough hoeing coming in to spawn. And then the juveniles, the resultant kids, will hang out in the pond for up to 5 or 6 months. Some of them won't drop out until December. If it's really good eating, they tend to stay longer. If it's pretty poor eating, they tend to leave earlier.
So, when I was down to Weber Pond, I saw a veteran bass fisherman who was fishing for bass, and I asked him a question. I said, "How long have you been fishing here?" He said, "Oh, years." And I said, "Has the fishing deteriorated since the alewives started becoming yearly guests here in the pond?" And his answer was, "Not that I could see. Yeah. Because everything is great." But then I got thinking about the fact that the alewife, Nate, has been a very controversial fish in Maine for a number of years now. The Down East guides were up in arms about the idea of alewives getting into Spedneck Lake, and today continue to contend that the alewife run is, one, it's not historical, they say, and two, it's going to destroy the coveted bass fishery at Spedneck Lake. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there is a lot of controversy surrounding that, and the decline in the Spedneck Lake bass fishery perceived by the guides had many causes. a good deal of which was the huge water drawdowns that they did throughout the summer to, you know, ramp up production for hydro generation, hydroelectric generation. And they'd literally draw Spednik down 14 feet. And that put the entire bathtub ring of the pond, it would turn it into a lunar landscape, which what had been submerged aquatic vegetation, it just dewatered it. And all the place, you know, all that habitat where the young fry would hang out turns into the moon, you know. And so, you know, they kept, you know, this repeated again and again and again and again. And you got to remember, we're on the northern tier of the limit of what smallmouth bass can handle as far as winter temperatures. And you add all that together, and then you throw alewives into the mix, and it's easy to jump from, you know, seeing lots of juvenile alewives and you know, thinking that you're seeing cause and effect with the commensurate decline in smallmouth bass recruitment. But that's really not what's happening. I mean,
well, reconcile this for me. The guides contend that if the alewives get into Spednik Lake, the alewives will eat the young bass fry. But according to you, alewives don't feed when they're on the spawning run. So what's the conflict there? How do you resolve that?
The young ones feed, don't they?
Yeah, the young ones feed.
Right.
To complete that picture, that, you know, alewives.
So you're saying the young alewives feed?
Yeah, they look like little silver dollars. I've seen them. Yeah.
Oh, and they will eat bass fry.
No,
they won't.
No. Okay. The adults typically don't eat on the spawning run. They're here to make kids,
yeah.
And they're very dedicated to that act. Now, reflexively, like Pacific salmon or Atlantic salmon, you know, you look at the flies that Atlantic salmon fish with, they will reflexively strike at that fly either out of anger or a memory of hunger. And the same thing will happen with alewives. They'll be swimming around just like you and me riding on our, you know, tractors mowing the lawn, and you'll inhale a black fly, you know. And,
yeah.
So it's accidental. It's not purposeful feeding. Sure. It's not hunting, you know.
Okay.
Now, the juveniles will swim around in the pond, and they'll hunt zooplankton. And the argument from the guide's point of view is, you know, you're worried about competition because virtually all juvenile fish species, when they're first born, are almost all planktivorous. I mean, they have to eat something, and they're very tiny, and, you know, plankton are small. But Mother Nature has a way of providing for all. So
could there be, to reverse this a little bit, and again, I'm not taking either side because I don't know, but could you reverse that and say that, well, in some areas then, the alewives could be feeding on the same plankton forage base as some of the young bass fry, right?
Yes, yeah, and we've studied that extensively, and what we found is that there's these tiers of feeding habit, and, you know, young bass fry don't typically, you know, they stay relatively close to the nest as they grow. Okay, they'll do, you know, forays out, okay? Yep. Alewives are schoolers, and they continuously move. They continuously move. And what we found through studies is that there's enough food, you know, that the smallmouth bass aren't getting starved out.
Okay. There's not. When you say food, you're talking about plankton.
Plankton, right. Zooplankton, yeah. Yep.
So you don't think that's an issue?
No.
Yeah. What about the argument they make that historically – the whole idea of bringing alewives back was to try to make it like it was before dams, et cetera, the natural, to try to have the natural state. The guides have argued vociferously that there's no historical evidence that alewives ever in our history made it into Spednik Lake. Have you followed these arguments?
Yes, very, very closely.
What do you think?
Well, we've seen this before. We've seen this argument before. We recently went through it on China Lake, right next door to where I work. And you have to look back at history with a somewhat, a very unbiased eye, understanding that a lot of the stuff that people took for granted back then, streams, rivers filled with alewives, shad, Atlantic salmon, nobody really sat down or in very few cases really wrote that down, you know, as the written word. But we can tell from archaeological evidence in that basin, you know, that the Native American contingent that was present at the time utilized alewives. well beyond Spednik Lake. You know, so there's two possibilities here. Either they paddled downstream and caught alewives and then paddled all the way back up to eat these things, or the alewives were swimming right to them. Being a lazy fella kind of myself, I'm voting for the alewives swim right to you, you know, and they're harvested right there on site. You know? Because, you know, alewife isn't going to last long unless you smoke it, you know, and you're going to want to eat it fresh.
Yeah.
And,
well, they were back in the, I don't know, the late 1800s, they were, weren't they, the local market, you could buy smoked alewives,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Consumption,
yeah.
So they had to get them somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when we look at, you know, the best we can tell is they historically got up in there. But written records, and the further down east you go, the further north and down east you go in Maine, you know, that was the frontier. As our occupation of the territory increased, you know, and the French were coming from the north, you know, the English were coming from the south, you know, there really wasn't much of a written record, and then it all turned in almost overnight into commerce, cutting down trees, putting in dams, you know.
Yeah.
And
I saw a headline in Bob's favorite daily newspaper today that that there's a shortage, a crisis of lobster bait. And alewives are being bought by lobstermen for bait, right?
Yes, it's one of the favored baits in the spring fishery for lobster is alewives.
And part of that alewife run that I saw in Weber Pond is being sold to lobstermen, right?
Yes, virtually all the commercially harvested bit of that run goes as lobster bait.
Okay.
So, you know, statutorily, the commercial alewife fisheries are allowed to run 4 days a week, and then escapement has to occur over 3 days to ensure that 4 years later you don't see a collapse in the returning adults.
Now, did these lobstermen get a pretty decent buy on these alewives as bait?
It's relatively speaking, because there's such a crisis on bait. I mean, they're shipping bait literally from halfway around the globe to get it into this fishery. These are redfish racks from the South Pacific, literally halfway around the globe. I mean, these are redfish racks from off the shores of New Zealand.
Wow.
That's how tight it is around here because of the decline in the Atlantic herring fishery, which was another staple in the bait part of things for the lobster fishing industry. Yeah. So, you know, we're seeing carp, you know, Asian carp being shipped over frozen as lobster. It's extremely expensive to go out and bait 800 pots.
Yeah, wow. Okay, again, our guest is Nate Gray. He's a fisheries biologist with Maine Department of Marine Resources, and we welcome your calls if you have a comment or a question for Nate at 1-800-966-1039. We have a bunch of other topics we'd like to pursue, but before we do, Bob Lehman is insisting that it's time for us to make a buck here on Maine Outdoors, and he's going to tell you all about one of our sponsors who's helped make the show possible every week.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it ever so much. And, of course, we have tonight one of our great sponsors for the show, again, is General Appliance in Brewer. And they're the place to go for your home or camp appliance needs, whether they are gas lights, gas ranges, gas refrigerators, gas freezers, or top-of-the-line compost toilets.
Ride the wave, baby.
Ride the wave, baby. You got it. And General Appliance is handled locally right here on 91 Center Street, handles all those wonderful appliances, and they also have electric appliances, Paul.
They do.
Yeah.
And is the guy that runs it over there, is he a pretty decent fellow? Al Elkin?
Oh, is that his name?
The guy that he wears that engineer's hat. There.
Boy, he knows his stuff, doesn't he?
Yes, does he? Does.
Yeah, sharp
guy. You give Al a call, and he'll run out and repair your appliance for you, whether you bought it there or you didn't buy it there, and that's something the big box stores cannot supply.
Prices are fair.
They certainly are, and every once in a while they have a big sale. In fact, they got another one coming right up, I understand. And they sell a lot of compost toilets. Right now, they're an awful nice thing to have. If you got one in your camp, then you won't have to go out with all those mosquitoes.
That's right. Huh? Okay, and what's the address over there if I want to find it?
91 Center Street. They're easy to get to from Bangor. Go across the Old Brewer Bridge, grab a right and a left. You're right on Center Street, and they got practically the whole block there on the right, and you can't miss them.
Okay. What a great job you did with it. You're just a pro.
Well, thank you so much.
You're a pro.
He's unforgettable.
Is he unforgettable or what? Unforgettable.
Is what you
now,
are.
The tough question, though, Bob, is without looking at the script, what's the telephone number if you want to call?
That I could not tell you.
Come on. It's on.
I have no idea.
It's on the top of my mind.
Well, say it.
989-7314.
There it is. That's it.
Huh? Is that fantastic for a guy 78 years old, huh?
It is.
You've got a memory unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, I take some of those vitamins that help my memory. Anyway, again, General Appliance and Brewer, we have the greatest respect for. They have run a wonderful shop.
They've been
shop
one
there.
Of our original sponsors for how many years?
Yeah, over 20 years now. So
boy,
we urge you to patronize them as we do.
Certainly do.
Getting back to our guest here, Nate. Some of the other things I'd be interested in talking about, there's been a phenomenal shift or change in the quality, not only the water quality, but the marine fishery when it comes to the Penobscot River and the Kennebec River. I'm more familiar with Penobscot because I live here, but I know the same thing's happening in the Kennebec River. And I'm going to give you a chance to address that, but first we have a caller standing by who may have a question for you.
Yes, we have John.
Okay, good evening, John. You're on Maine Outdoors with the fisheries biologist, Nate Gray.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, so I moved to Maine about 20 years ago and kind of went to a seminar Saco Bay Tackle put on and ended up 11 miles off Tantus Ledge and like loaded up on codfish, beautiful fish. I think it was maybe a 10-fish limit. And then, now 20 years later, there's good haddock fishing. Beautiful cod coming back, but you can't keep any. And it's been a, 24-inch fish between August 1 to, I think, September 30th and kind of some years. And then some years you can't keep a one. And is it, obviously there's more 15-pound cod out there than I've seen in quite a while. Does that look positive for the future, kind of like the haddock are right now, or is this going to be a yo-yo thing with allocations and all that?
Yeah, John, I think you just nailed it on the head. As a state, we have some regulatory authority, but cod and groundfish, it's a multi-state regulatory body that follows and tracks these stocks and forming the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. So it is going to be a yo-yo ride, and they're going to keep re-looking at the cod stocks because the fishery was so depleted, and they want to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Okay. Well, my understanding was that they figured with the directed effort on the haddock that the catch and release mortality on the cod was substantial enough that that's why the rec sector is not allowed to keep any. But they figured, well, you're killing your share by releasing them.
Yeah. And if you're bringing a fish up from 40 fathom, it's pretty tough on them. So that was the concern there. They come up from great depth.
It seems like if the short haddock and the pollock, short pollock, they belly up most. Have UNH had a cool release. UNE had a cool release tool for promoting releasing cusk because of the longevity, and it's like a clothespin on you put on your teaser and you drop them down and just give it a little yank and it releases a bad depth.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
All right.
Well, thanks.
Okay, appreciate the
call.
John. Good questions, John. Thank you. We were talking about the Kennebec River. Could you just give us kind of a profile summary of what exciting things are happening on the Kennebec River right now?
Yeah, it's almost impossible to put into words. It's one of those things, it's like having children. You can try to describe it to somebody else, but they're not going to know until they go. When I first started working on the project in 92, Edwards Dam was still in. We'd struggle literally 14 hours a day, 7 days a week with a crew of five guys to catch enough fish to drag them up basin to dump them into historical habitat like places like Unity Pond and Sebasticook Lake. On the Sebasticook Basin, and then of course in '99 Edwards Dam comes out, and we had installed several fish passages further upstream. We opened up the Sebasticook. Fort Halifax Dam came out in 2008, another contentious battle, but it did come out. And suddenly the system is effectively, with the installation of fish passages, open to the ocean. And all the effort, the previous effort by truck stocking, started to take off, and we got to see these recruitment curves on alewives and blueback herring, river herring collectively, start to climb precipitously. And I meant to bring a graph with me, which isn't very much use on the radio, but we saw returns at Benton Falls, which is one of our principal counting stations, a hydroelectric facility in Benton, Maine, climb, 400,000, 500,000. And then it went to 800,000, and then 1.1 million, and then 2.2 million. And this year was a record year at Benton Falls, 5.3 million fish. Now, you can't make this much food and not attract a huge pile of customers. And we see them come in all shapes and colors, from the easily recognized bald eagles. We've actually seen seals, 70-plus miles from the ocean chasing these fish well inland. Osprey, great blue heron, otters, you name it, they're coming to the to
yeah,
feed.
That to me was one of the exciting aspects of this. The term the biologists use, they call it the cascading effect.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you get all these fish in there, and you got this tremendous food supply, so you're going to get all kinds of new critters.
Yeah.
Critters that fly, critters that walk there, swim, right?
Right.
Yeah. So it's going to change the whole character.
Yeah.
Of the watershed, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and we refer to this species, river herring, alewives, and bluebacks collectively, as a keystone species. I mean, it sounds cliche, but what I can tell you is that, the base of the food chain, or as close to the base as you can get and still actually eat it, you don't get much more bang for the buck than that. And the importance of that can't be overstated. I mean, even something so sublime as a yellow warbler directly benefits from the presence of these fish, even though yellow warblers will never touch an alewife in their life. But the mere presence of these fish increases the productivity level of the water body it's on, and it makes more bugs, and that's what the warbler eats.
Like any part of nature, everything is intricately
connected.
Interwoven, connected.
Yes.
So it's probably difficult to even speculate on extrapolating this to the nth degree.
Yeah,
right?
A lot of us, well, there isn't very many of us that work on this, on these projects, but you come to a quick understanding of the huge canvas that God provides for, these fish. I mean, the amount of lives that they touch in their life, and they can live up to be 9 years old. They don't die after they spawn. I mean, it's...
You mentioned all these fish, Nate, and one of the early runners is the elevers, and then before them even is the tommy cod.
Yes, sir.
And can you talk a little bit about the tommy cod? That's something you hardly ever hear about.
Yeah, the tom cod is one of our pantheon of diadromous fish, the anadromous form, and they come in, they call them frost fish, and they'll come in late winter along with the smelt and spawn underneath the ice. And and they look exactly like their giant cousins, the Atlantic cod, and but
they're good to eat.
You can eat them.
They say that my father used to catch them years ago.
Yeah, people used to eat them by the bucketful.
No kidding. Ice. Yeah,
yeah, because back in the day, and you think about it, back in the day, this is important to recognize this. As colonials, when we came here, there was no Shaws, there was no Hannaford, there was no nothing. So you either built it, caught it, grew it, or you starved to death,
right.
And tommy cod was a regular bit. So we're
by
eels.
The barrel, they got
So will they be coming back, do you think?
We keep track of them as part of the keeping track of the smelt fish. Yep. We try to keep track of what the tom cod are doing.
So they're in
too.
There now.
Oh yeah,
they come back every year. Yeah, December, January.
Yeah, December, January.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
How big are they?
I caught
average.
Yeah, usually the average is about 9-10 inches.
Oh, they're small.
Yeah, they're small. However, I caught two this past winter smelt fishing that were absolute horses in the tommy cod end of things, and they were a foot long and a pound and a half apiece.
Oh well,
and that's enough to feed a couple people right there.
Beautiful
fish.
Before we run out of time, it's customary on our program to ask, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, to ask fishing-type questions. I know you're a sport fisherman.
Yes.
And Bob Lehman is dying to know two things. One, what is your favorite fish to fish? And as a fly fisherman, do you have a couple of favorite flies you could tell us about?
Oh, yeah. Okay, my favorite fish to fish is what I grew up fishing for, which is brook trout, native brook trout,
yeah.
Naturally occurring native brook trout. That's my favorite thing to fish more. Mm. My favorite fly to fish for brook trout that I have the most success with, I lie, there's two of them. It's the muddler minnow and the hare's ear.
Hare's ear.
Yeah, that's what I have the most luck with because they imitate just about everything. You know?
Well, what size muddler do you prefer?
Usually the number 6 or number 8, you know, pretty decent mm-hmm. sized, you know, and you can fish it about, you know, you can fish it wet, you can fish it partially dressed on the surface like an emerger.
Yep. Yeah.
It has so many traits. You can clip it back, you can color it. I usually carry at least a black Sharpie with me, you know, so I can dress one up dark, real dark. Just
oh,
like that.
I never heard, thought of that.
Oh, yeah, it works.
Color it with a Sharpie.
Yeah, it works really good. And,
you could do that to a buff-colored elk hair caddis,
yes,
too, couldn't you?
Yeah, and you take a pair of, you know, it depends on what you see for emerges. You can take, you know, and they're easy to tie as a fly. So is the hare's ear, and you can tie up a whole basket full of them in a night.
Yes, a second.
Yep.
And you can use them for the hexagenia.
Yes. Yep.
Right?
Yep. You can dress them down too. You take out your clippers and clip off the back end of them and shorten them right up.
That's right.
You recently returned from Alaska fishing rainbows up there in one of their fabulous
yep.
rivers.
Yep.
What type of terminal equipment were you using up there, Nate?
This is gonna alarm some people. The rainbows up there are fantastically large, and I believe it or not, I run a 9-weight rod. I'm running a bonefish slick, a clear right. neutral density line, and a giant black conehead leech. And I'm dredging them off the bottom. And if you're patient about it, and you know, literally a 75-yard section of water will take you 6 hours to fish because you're just sweeping the bottom,
Cool. Yeah.
A nine weight rod. Yeah, that's a hefty rod.
Well, the fish, I broke off three. The biggest I landed was 29 inches, and the biggest I've landed there in the past is 30 1/4 inches.
Wow, great fishing.
They're huge rainbows. Yeah.
Nine for nine.
Yeah, right?
So?
Yep.
I think we are out of time. I want to thank you very much for showing up. I'm glad you came in person.
Yeah, you have to come back again, Nate.
You invite me, I will come.
All right,
we've got a lot of questions for you.
Right. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Have a good summer.
Yeah, you too.
Our guest next week here at Maine Outdoors will be Jake Morrill, who is a bush pilot. He's written a second book about Dick Folsom, which I think you'll find that interesting, Scotty.
And for Dick.
You did. Well, you'll have a chance to question Jake next week right here on
Maine Outdoors.